GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
And I think he's got some good points.
What he's basically saying is, how from last year.
Tango Tango Papa 1283, February 23rd, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Thank you.
That's called The O of Pleasure, and it's by Ray Lynch. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Marietta, Ohio. I was, of course, last night at Disputanta, Virginia, and then so this morning I got up and drove up there to the Richmond area, Sandston, Virginia, suburban Richmond. Basically, it's indistinguishable from Richmond. It's out on the, you know, kind of on the edge. And so was there probably for a couple of hours or a little more. They loaded my trailer, and then after that got headed up here towards Marietta, Ohio. It's fairly warm today. It was in the, I think, in, you know, in the Richmond area, it was probably around 50 degrees, or I don't know. It was warm enough to not really need a jacket. I guess if you were going to be outside real, you know, a long time, you might want some sort of a small jacket, light jacket. But otherwise, just out walking around wasn't bad at all, so I didn't even bother with the jacket today. As I made my way, you know, I think the lowest temperature that I saw was about 39 degrees. But, you know, that is, now I don't know, and I think here it's probably about 44. And I did run into some rain part of the way, you know, kind of drizzle type stuff, and then right now it's not doing anything. It's just cloudy, of course. Been cloudy all day. So there's still snow on the ground here, but a lot of it obviously has melted. So you know, I think things have warmed up a little bit. Now I don't know how long that's going to last. Haven't really paid a bit of attention to the weather, so it won't last. But I think people are, you know, after, you know, the last couple of weeks, people are really enjoying the warmer weather, so you know, get a little relief from it. So anyway, let me talk a little bit about GoToMeeting. Work smarter in 2010. Use GoToMeeting to meet clients and colleagues online. With GoToMeeting, brought to you by Citrix, you can save time and money by holding meetings online. Instead of driving or flying to meet in person, use GoToMeeting to conduct sales presentations, product demos, training sessions right from your desk. Stay productive, be efficient, and avoid the hassle of unnecessary travel. Use GoToMeeting, and you won't be able to remember how you did business without it. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days, but you must visit GoToMeeting.com/podcast. That's GoToMeeting.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. So let me close out of that. Now, what I have, I've got a couple more of these older films, the audio that I downloaded yesterday from archive.org. I'm really kind of enamored with these things right now. And, of course, my podcast is always what I'm thinking about kind of currently, and you know, I'm finding that, you know, these older films, like from the, basically from, some of them are from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, or at least the early part of the 60s, what I'm finding is that a lot of them were really, I don't know, they didn't ridicule the way stuff does today. You know, a lot of the stuff that's produced today, at least what we encounter even stuff on YouTube that's user generated, a lot of it ridicules it. You know, it's ridiculing everything. And the thing that I find fascinating about, you know, these older films, you know, from 30s, 40s, and 50s, and the early part of the 60s, they really have a tendency to, you know, they're really sort of edifying. Now a lot of these, I don't know, some of these were aimed at the general public, a lot of them were, some of them that I found were aimed at, they'd be films that would probably be shown in schools or maybe civic groups, but they really seemed to be aimed at trying to get people to, sort of adhere to certain standards, and, you know, certain standards of conduct, certain standards of behavior. And that seems to be one of the common themes from these films. And a lot of these films, you know, companies made them. There were different production companies that made them. Some of them were General Motors. I mean, you know, there's just, there are literally thousands of them to kind of pick through, and of course I just I'm on limited bandwidth. So yesterday I was able to download a number of them, but there's still plenty to pick through, and I'm sure there's some real gems out there just waiting to be found. And of course, you know, there a good portion of them are on archive.org, and you know, and that's not even counting all the older advertisements. You know, it's quite amazing what is out there. The result of the basically it was the culture, and I think starting sometime in the 60s, our culture really started to change. Now, I think what happened, and, you know, you can go back and you can talk about the greatest generation, the guys that, had to win World War II. And I think what happened after that, the people came back, and, you know, that's when the baby boom started, the so-called baby boom generation. And I think that baby boom generation, for the most part, was spoiled. There were a lot of kids that were being born, and there were a lot of them. That's when the spoiling started. And those people are still alive today. You know, I'm part of that so-called baby boom generation. You know, I forget, you know, roughly I don't remember the dates that they specify roughly for the baby boom generation, but it encompasses probably, you know, all of the, you know, starting sometime in the early 50s and then probably sometime into the 60s is kind of considered the baby boom generation. So, you know, I certainly fall into that category because I was born in 1955. And so I think that generation, for the most part, was spoiled. And that's when the real problems of cultural rot, cultural decay, moral decay, moral decline started. And so it's unfortunate that happened, but it does seem to happen to every society. You look at every society in the history of the world, and every one of them has gone, you know, they go through an ascending period, and then they go through a descending period. And of course, you know, with the Roman Empire, they had roughly 400 years of, you know, where they were on their way up, and then 400 years roughly of decline. And of course, in those days, you didn't have all the communications that we have today. Communications, as I've you know, talked about in the past quite a bit. Communications has a tendency to speed things up. Whatever the outcome is going to be is vastly sped up. If you can, if you know, not that many years ago, before the internet, I would write letters to people, and before computers, I would actually write them out in longhand. So you just imagine you write out a letter and you put it in the mail and you send it to whoever, and then they write out, they get it and they read it, and then they write out a response and they put it in the mail and send it back to you. Well, after, you know, of course the computer came along, and then the word processing software, but the internet obviously still didn't exist, and so I was typing instead of writing it out in longhand, I was typing it. But I was still putting it in an envelope and mailing it, and then the person would receive it, and they'd mail they'd type out a response and send it back, send me the response back. That was somewhat of an improvement, but nonetheless, it wasn't, what really changed things is when email came along, and that vastly sped things up, because whatever the outcome was going to be, all of a sudden, you've got instant access basically to everything. Every person that has an email address that you might want to correspond with, every company that you might want to do business with, it's all out there instantly available. And so you can just, I can right now, if I decide I want to look up a whatever, if I have an idea of some product I want to buy, I can instantly look online, find it, and within a few minutes I've made the purchase and, kind of forgotten about it, and then it gets delivered to me. Whereas, in years past, you'd have to go digging around and try to find, let's say you wanted to buy whatever it was, you'd have to dig around and maybe write to the company and get them to send you a catalog, or you might want to call them on the phone, or you'd have to physically go somewhere, and in this example, like to buy a product of some sort. So, today, you can have an idea and instantly communicate that idea to somebody, and immediately that idea is out there, and that the person you communicated the idea with, the idea to, instantly has it. And so the net effect is that things have been vastly sped up. And so that's kind of a double-edged sword, because it not only can it improve products, it certainly improves commerce, and it vastly improves social interaction. But on the other hand, if there's a problem, if there's a decline, let's say a decline in morality is underway, then it can vastly speed that process up too. And so the improved communications is one of the reasons why America is, and the world largely, is in such a moral decline, such a rapid moral decline. So, I was thinking earlier, and I don't know how well I can express this idea, but I was listening to the next to the last one today. I listened back to it, the one where I played the thing about the electric eel, and towards the end of it I was talking about, you look out on a clear night, and you can see the little fuzzy galaxy, and that light is a million years old that you're seeing, that's hitting your retina. You're seeing this little fuzzy thing with your naked eye. That light is a million years old, and that got me to thinking. Here we are on this earth. Just imagine human beings, all of a sudden, here's human beings. You know, and here we are, and we're on this land. We have daytime, we have nighttime, we have seasons that come and go on a kind of a predictable basis. You know, and we have no idea where we are. Where are we? We're on this land. You know, where did this come from? That's kind of a mystery. You know, and we've kind of figured out, well, we're on this ball. But this ball is floating out in the middle of nowhere. You know, and you get away from the ball and, you know, let's say you climb up on a mountain and it's cold. You know, you get a higher elevation, it's cold up there. You know, so, you know, of course, we figured out since then that we're in space. You know, we gave it a name, it's space. And, you know, we gave all that space around us, you know, with all the extremely distant objects, it's a universe. But if you think about it, we're just little tiny nothing creatures on a little speck of dust, you know, on a cosmic scale. The Earth is a speck of dust. It's nothing compared to the rest of the universe. And so here we are on our little ball, you know, on a cosmic scale again. You know, we're right next to the sun. You know, it's 9 minutes away. You know, the speed of light, it's 93 million miles away. But nonetheless, you know, so on a cosmic scale, 93 million miles is nothing. We're right on top of that sun. And so here we are on this ball, and we're kind of floating in space. We're just little tiny creatures on this ball. Compared to the Earth, we're nothing. So, you know, we're out here, we're isolated on this little ball, and we've got our civilization, you know, and, you know, it's still a mystery. It's an incredible mystery. Why do we exist? You know, and there are people that try to explain that, you know, and they've, you know, of course you get the idea, well, it just happened. It was just evolution. It just happened. Somehow it just happened. You know, or we were created. We were brought into existence. You know, I do believe evolution, some sort of evolution happened. We, as human beings, are the result of biological activity. Of, you know, now I think that there are, you know, even if you say there are basic rules for biological activity, and, you know, what drives those, what made those rules? Did those rules just happen to have, did they just happen to, I guess? It's obvious to me that there's a creator. There is a creator that brought all of this into existence. There's a creator that sustains, that same creator sustains this existence from moment to moment. And that same creator brought us into existence. You know, and so, you know, and then of course that same creator also offers us our identity. But of course we have a choice. We have a choice that animals don't have. Animals are hardwired for the most part. You know, you can, you know, name any creature on this earth, any other living creature, it's hardwired. It has to be what it is. It has no choice. It's not even aware. You know, you can take the most intelligent animal, and it's not even aware of its own existence. You know, you can take a monkey or whatever, and it can look up at that, you know, that million-year-old light, if it can see it, you know, coming from however many light years away, and it has no idea what it's looking at. It's not aware. It's not aware that it's aware of its, you know, whatever it is. It's aware of its own little world, but it doesn't wonder how it came to be. It doesn't have that capacity. And it doesn't wonder where it gets its identity, because it just has its identity. It just is. We as human beings have a choice. We can either follow that, you know, kind of latent identity that our Creator imparts to us, or we have the choice. We have the choice to try to, you know, go awry, basically. Play God ourselves. Play God in our own minds. And of course, we go awry for the most part. And so it's an interesting thing. It's a very interesting thing. So in any case, rather than me continuing to talk too long, I want to go ahead and, let's see, which one of these do I want to play? I'm going to go ahead and play this one. This is a film from 1940, and I think it was probably originally aimed at high school kids, and it's, Finding Your Life's Work. And it's really very interesting because I like the, it's really giving, whoever watched this, it really imparts, it's really telling them basically how to go about looking for a job, and sort of they have to try to decide what they want to do, and so on and so forth, and it's really pretty interesting. And it's very, overall, it's a very positive message, and I think it's really typical. As I say, it's typical for the times, you know, the 30s, the 40s, 50s, early part of the 60s. It's very typical, but it has a very positive message. So here we go. This is called Finding Your Life's Work.
Fish without any bait? Of course you didn't. Every fisherman knows there's nothing about a bare hook to attract. On the hook there must be some kind of bait. An artificial fly, a worm, a minnow, or a frog to attract the fish and cause him to strike. Without this bait, you'd come home at the end of the day disappointed. When you're searching for work, you're fishing for a job. What you catch will be determined largely by the bait you offer. Your personality, training, and experience are your bait. If you have little or no training, you probably will catch little or nothing in the way of a job. The fisherman uses special baits for the game fish. To get the better jobs, you must also use special baits in the form of special qualifications. There are fewer game jobs to be caught. The fisherman has the ambition to catch the game fish. In the same way, every person has the ambition someday to land the big job. There's beginner's luck in fishing, and beginner's luck can't count on luck. Getting a job is your training. In choosing your life work, there are many things to be considered. First of all, you must know yourself, your strong point, your weakness, your likes and dislikes. Let us consider first your own native abilities. Tests have been developed which help you to measure your abilities. Of particular value are those called aptitude tests, which help you measure your abilities in special fields. Mechanical aptitude tests are a sample of this type. These cannot tell you exactly the occupation to choose, but they give you an idea of the type of work you can do best. They also help to guide you away from some fields in which you won't be successful. Each person has the ability to do just so much work, which is called his level of capacity. If he tries to do more than he's really able, he'll be unhappy in his work. He will also be dissatisfied if he knows he could handle a better job than the one he has. There are tests which will help you choose work which fits your level of capacity best. How simple it would be to choose your life work if taking tests were the only thing you had to do in analyzing yourself. But they are only the first step. Another step in analyzing yourself is the examination of your own educational record. Your grades in different subjects, back as far as can be traced. If you've gotten this, your teacher is with you and looking it up. What does your educational record show? Have your grades been about the same all along the line? Or do they look like this, up and down, like the crest and trough of an ocean wave? In what subjects have your grades been up? In what subjects have they been down? Why have they been up or down? Are you especially interested in certain subjects? If you don't like mathematics and your grades are low in this subject, you probably won't be very successful in those fields based on mathematics. Why are you interested in some subjects and not in others? You must answer these questions if you really wish to get acquainted with yourself. When you get a job, you will be judged in comparison with other workers. Just as in school, your work is graded in comparison with that of your classmates. All workers in any group are so judged. One will be considered the best in the group, another the poorest, with the rest arranged in between. This first today may not be first tomorrow unless he keeps on his toes and is alert to the changes which are constantly taking place in every line of work. Therefore, you should know what your rank in your class is in order that you may strive to raise or maintain it. Do you belong in the upper one-fourth? Upper one-half? We hope you're not near the bottom. Another very important question you must ask yourself concerns your character. You will probably agree that honesty and loyalty are two of the strongest points of character. Are you honest with yourself? Are you honest with others? Are you loyal? The next point concerns your interests and accomplishments. In what are you especially interested? What can you do well? Do you like to work with ideas? Or would you rather work with things? List the things you like and that you do well and study them for a possible life work. We all realize that interests change frequently, but if the interest is strong and is based upon some real ability or accomplishment, it will grow. In fact, the more skilled you become, the faster your interest will grow, and so it may help you in picking your life work. Your social assets are very valuable in helping you to know yourself. Do you get along well with the gang, or do you have frequent fallouts? Do you prefer going with the crowd? Or would you rather spend the day alone, doing something you like to do? Do you do your best work when working with other people or when working alone? This is important in determining your future work. For one who likes to be alone would be unhappy in a job which required him to work as a member of a group and to be dependent upon others. The research worker is generally of the type who prefers to work alone. The successful salesman is largely dependent upon his ability to make a pleasing impression upon those with whom he comes in contact. Determination to succeed is an important factor in success. When things go wrong, do you say, "I can't"? If your grades fall below your expectations, do you say, "What's the use"? Every subject in the school has its part in rounding out your education. Do you say, "I don't see any sense in studying something I'll never use"? How do you know you'll never use it? When the road ahead of you is not entirely clear, do you continue to do your best? There is no place in success for a quitter. Are you a quitter? Your financial assets must receive consideration in choosing your life work. Does your choice require long and expensive training? Will you have the money? Will you need considerable money for equipment when you have completed your training and are ready to start work? Will you be able to finance yourself until you have an income from your own work? Many people train themselves for jobs and then are forced to do something else for lack of finances to get started. Every person should have one or more hobbies which he can do well and from which he derives pleasure and satisfaction. A hobby helps you relax after a hard day's work. It may also provide a job to fall back upon in case something happens to your regular means of earning a living. Many people today are working at things which were their hobbies a few years ago. May we ask, what is your hobby? What do you expect to get out of your life work? Many would answer money. Money is important for the things that it will buy, and a certain amount of it is therefore necessary. As important as money, however, as a return for your work, is the satisfaction that comes from doing an interesting job as well as or better than others are doing it. If you set such satisfaction as your goal, expect the financial part to serve itself. Considerable time has been given to the problem of knowing yourself. It is the most difficult problem facing you, but it must be faced. Now, let's turn to some of the questions involved in studying occupations. It is well to get clearly in mind that each one of you can do several things successfully. No individual is limited to one occupation alone. You are at the point where the road has many branches. Any one of the several branches will get you to your destination, but many of them would lead you away from your goal. How can you find the right roads? If you wish to get the most out of your study of the occupations, you must follow some definite plan. First, you should get a broad view of as many occupations as possible. One way you can do this is by reading. There are many books and magazines which give quite clear word pictures of various fields of work, but this is not enough. You should talk to successful people in many lines, asking them questions about their work, the training required, where to get it, and the rewards of their occupations. Your school again will be glad to assist by arranging such conferences for you. There are many movies dealing with occupations, and from time to time you're going to see some of these. They will acquaint you with many types of work in various parts of the country. In making your investigation, do not limit yourself to your own locality, but make your survey as broad as possible. When you have completed a broad survey, choose those occupations that interest you for further study. Investigate the unpleasant side of the work as well as the pleasant, for every type of work has its disagreeable side. No occupation has ever satisfied the worker all the time, but the pleasant thing should greatly outweigh the unpleasant if you're seriously considering that particular occupation. This step will cause you to cross some off your list because you feel that the disadvantages outweigh the advantages. Make an intensive study of the remaining interesting occupations. You will now want to ask some questions concerning them. What does the worker do? Is the occupier crowded? What are the starting points and lines of promotion? What are the future prospects for earnings and advancement? What general and special education is required? Where can it be secured? What will this education cost? What will it cost to get established in this occupation? What are the physical requirements? Is it apt to be detrimental to my health? Would I be happy in this work? Many more questions will occur to you as you study the occupations. And remember, you cannot know too much about the work into which you decide to go. While in school, you have all about you many opportunities to improve yourself. Are you making the most of them? The modern school consists of many departments, each contributing its part to make possible a broad educational background that will be valuable in your adult life. The English department offers courses which will help you to speak and write correctly. Courses in literature acquaint you with the world's literary masterpieces, so you can discover for yourself the pleasure to be found in reading them. The social science group provides a chance to study the past, so that you can better understand the conditions of today. Everyone should know more about his government in order that he may be a more useful citizen. Modern developments in transportation and communication have brought cities, states, and nations of the world so close together that we are all subject to the same influences. And no matter what we do for a living, we have many new problems in human relationships which must be solved. A study of the social sciences helps us understand these problems. Mathematics gives you training in arithmetic and shows you how to use it in problems which come up constantly in your everyday life. you must have higher mathematics to succeed in some occupations. In the study of mathematics, you develop your ability for systematic, logical, and accurate reasoning. The sciences, natural and physical, have an influence on the production of everything you eat, wear, or use. For this reason, the sciences play a very direct part in your life, and you should learn to understand and appreciate them. Physical training aims at a healthy body through exercise and planned recreation. If you lose your health, it is difficult and expensive to regain it. The progress of the human race can be traced through its development in music and art. Few people can become SIS books in many fields will be found, and the individual is free to read according to his interests. And offers courses in accounting, shorthand, and typing that develop skills through which you may get a job in the commercial world. But even if you never do cover work, you should understand fundamental business principles and be able to apply them in your everyday life. The homemaking department, through its courses in cooking, child care, and home management, trains girls to be good housewives. Courses in sewing are also valuable, whether a girl expects to keep house or enter the business world. The development of good buying judgment is of highest importance, for according to economists, women do at least 75% of the nation's buying. The industrial arts department will help you in four main ways. First, to learn about industrial design, materials, processes, and products, so that you will know more about manufacturing and industry and their effect upon your own life. Second, to learn how to buy and use industrial products more intelligently. Third, to help you learn the fundamental tool processes. If you never use this skill in an actual job, it will always come in handy and may be fun for you as a hobby. And fourth, you have a chance to try out your ability in a number of kinds of industrial work which may guide you in the choice of one for making your living. Schools have agriculture departments which cover the latest developments in farm crops, animal husbandry, farm management, and other important matters which are of value to the owner or operator of a farm. Now comes another very important part of discussion of your life work. What is education? Education starts very early and continues throughout life, from birth to death. Education is the total of all your experiences, both real and imaginary, in school and outside of school. In fact, life itself is education. Many adults go to night school to acquire additional training to improve themselves. For the more experience or education you have in regard to any problem, the greater your chance of solving the problem correctly. We all know that coordination of the mind and body is necessary in most of the games we play. It is just as necessary in most jobs. To do your life work successfully, you must at all times have perfect coordination. The importance of coordination is shown in a study of the type of work done in over 4,000 occupations listed by the Census Bureau. Suppose that these 100 figures stand for all the workers in those 4,000 occupations, most of the workers in the country. Out of every 100, only 13 workers have jobs based entirely on mental skills, or which require them to work with their minds alone. Only 18 out of every 100 have jobs based on manual skills, in which they work mainly with their hands. All these that are left, or 69 out of every 100, do work requiring that the hand and mind be trained together for perfect coordination. You will probably be one of the 69, for perfect coordination is necessary for the dentist, the typist, the industrial worker, the homemaker, in fact, for almost everyone. Just as a building must be built on a carefully planned foundation, so must your life be built on careful plans. Let us see if we can plan the foundation of a successful career for you. As the first block of your foundation, you must have health. Without health, no one can be entirely successful. The second block is character. Develop your character. Your general education is the third block of your foundation. Keep your educational record clear. The fourth block is citizenship. Are you a good citizen? Next comes your special interests and abilities. Are you finding and developing? Ambition is the spark plug of the human engine, the force that makes things happen. Do you need a new spark plug? You may have special abilities and ambition, but are you willing to work hard to succeed? There is no shortcut to success. You should know yourself better than anyone else knows you. Get acquainted with yourself. The bigger the job, the more training required. Are you planning to get that training? On top of this base, you can place the stone of success, confident that your foundation is well laid. Examine your foundations, and never for one moment believe anyone who may try to tell you that you can't achieve success in this country today. It's true that competition is keen, the standards by which you will be measured are high. Opportunity isn't likely to knock at your door. You'll have to go out and hunt it for yourself. But the opportunity is there if you're prepared to take advantage of it. There are thousands of occupations awaiting the workers who are qualified to fill them. There are jobs in journalism. Munts turn out thousands of newspapers every day. The reporter today has to work hard to get the news. He has to be able to write so people will read his copy. But so did reporters 50 years ago. There are jobs in livestock farming and dairy farming. The farmers' long hours, but so have farmers for centuries past. There are jobs in new lines of work, radio and television. Millionaires have always been few number. Somewhere in this great land, there is a chance for you to make a living and lead a happy life. Americans have always made their own opportunities. It's up to you to make yours.
Okay, so that was called Finding Your Life's Work, and that was from 1940. Very uplifting. It had a, you know, kind of an uplifting, positive message. And of course, you got to remember, 1940, they just came out of, I guess they were just coming out of the Great Depression. And, or, you know, maybe, I don't know, I'd have to go back and look at the timeline. But, you know, so they were talking about, you know, they kind of admitted, hey, the jobs are few and far between. And, but they were still, you know, kind of pushing a positive message. And, you know, I like the analogy that they were using with fishing. You know, because if you don't have the right bait, then you're not going to catch anything. You know, and so if you're looking for a job, then you got to have the right bait. And I think a lot of people today don't realize that. They just think that someone owes them a living. You know, the companies exist just to give them benefits. And that's not the way it works. You know, and again, it goes back to the fact that I think that the baby boom generation was spoiled. And then, of course, they really spoiled their kids. And then, of course, you had the school system, you know, our nationalized public school system, starting in the 60s, really started going downhill. It was, you know, it was rotten when I was in school, you know, to be perfectly honest. School was rotten then, and I can only imagine how rotten it is today. You know, the news, if you dig around, you don't have to dig very far, and you find all kinds of horrible stories about insane school systems. And, you know, I'm just glad that I don't, you know, I don't have any kids to send to a place like that. And, you know, of course, knowing what I know now, if I ever did have a kid, there is no way I would ever send them to public school. I would either make the sacrifice to homeschool them or find a good private school. One of the two. But there's no way that I'd, you know, send them off to, you know, be indoctrinated, because that's, they're basically, the public school systems don't for the most part. There might be some, there's exceptions, of course, but they're just indoctrination centers, you know, and it just, you know, they ruin the kids' minds, poison them. So, you know, and it's no different than, you know, they might as well be, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, because it's, you know, look how they poison the minds of their kids. And, you know, you have the, like the Palestinians, you know, with the, use their kids to blow, you know, use them as bombs, basically. And so that's basically what we're doing. It's just more subtle. It's just more subtle with our public school system, but it's, you know, it's basically the same principles. We're just, you know, they're used as sort of a subtle bomb to blow up the society. I've got this other one. Let's see. Yeah, 10 minutes and 52 seconds. I've got this other one that was actually produced by the, you know, the Bell System. This is from 1951, and they're talking about direct dial long distance. And I think it's pretty interesting to listen to and you know, kind of see how the technology has changed over the years. So this is from, again, 1951, and it's from the Bell System.
Across the Hudson River from New York City and westward into the state of New Jersey is the city of Englewood. Englewood could be any one of hundreds of American communities, population 25,000, Main Street with busy stores, banks, and movie theaters, attractive suburban homes with their neat lawns and their well-groomed look. In size and in the kind of people who live here, Englewood is like many other American towns. And that was one of the reasons it has become the first town in the world to have an unusual kind of telephone service.
Oh, I'll go see over there.
You finish your coffee, John. I'll answer it. Probably the mailman. John, it's from Sally. She says the baby has the measles. Oh, dear.
Well, now, measles, that's not so serious. All kids get them sooner or later.
John Warren, you know Ruthie is only 14 months old. Poor little dear. I'm worried.
Well, if you're worried, why don't you call her up? You got her number in that little book of yours. It's just about 8 o'clock in San Francisco. They'll be up.
No, I believe I will.
Go ahead. Call her. You'll feel better.
Sure it isn't too early out there?
Oh, no, it's 11 o'clock here. That means it's 8 o'clock out there.
Hello? Sally? Sally, this is Mother.
Simple, wasn't it? She just picked up her telephone and dialed her daughter in San Francisco, California. In a matter of seconds, she is talking with her. Simple. And yet you are seeing the results of many, many years of coordinated effort in research, engineering, and operating experience. It's hard for us to realize today that in the early 1880s, the telephone was considered a newfangled contraption. boy operators manned the switchboards in those days, and it was an adventure to be able to talk with friends or relatives on the other side of town. The telephone at last was filling a deep human need, the need of people separated from one another to talk with each other. Soon, alert girl operators replaced the boys. New types of instruments were developed, and the telephone grew up with a growing America. The demand for telephone service snowballed. Indeed, the use of the telephone became so tremendous that by the 1920s, dial service was rapidly being introduced to help handle the increased volume of calls. As the calls increased, more operators were needed. More calls to handle meant more jobs to do and more people to fill those jobs. This has been the story all through the development of the telephone. For instance, in the days when we had little or no dial service, the Bell system had 270,000 employees. By the time 70% of the telephones were dial, there were 600,000 employees, more than twice as many. But the remarkable use of the telephone was only part of the story of change in American life. As villages became towns, and towns became industrial cities, people's interests broadened. Where those early citizens were thrilled to telephone across town, people now wanted to call towns and cities across the nation. Finally, they wanted their voices to span the oceans. And they did. Truly, America had grown up. All of which brings us back to Englewood. From many of Englewood's telephones, you could already dial any one of more than 4 million other telephones in the surrounding territory. A fine example of modern telephone service, and therefore a fine proving ground for this new type of long-distance service. A proving ground to answer such questions as, will customers like the service? Do they find it easy to use? What improvements can be made? This first installation now enables telephone users to dial their own long-distance calls, as well as their local calls and calls to nearby communities. The equipment that makes this service possible is among the most complex that man has ever devised. When you dial a number, the equipment obediently receives the information, stores it up, and remembers it. It searches out an electrical pathway for your call, choosing the one that is most suitable at a given instant. If it finds one pathway blocked, it tries another, and another, and another. If it runs into trouble, it automatically reports the trouble and its probable source. Parts of the equipment connected with other parts exchange information. They do this sometimes by a touch system, such as the blind use in reading Braille. Sometimes it's done with a stream of electrons flowing through space. Sometimes it uses an elaborate system of musical notes, played in chords that are heard and interpreted by a mechanical ear. But even that's not all of it. Keeping track of the details of the call is done automatically too. When you dial a number, holes are punched in a continuous tape representing your telephone number and the number you dial. More holes are punched to show the time when you start talking and when you finish talking and hang up. If you get a busy signal or the number doesn't answer, no charge is made. Since all this information is in the form of tiny holes in a long piece of paper, the meaning of these tiny holes has to be expressed in words and figures. This is done by running the tape through several machines which assemble the information, translate, sort, and summarize it. Figure the length of your call, apply the correct rate, and, you guessed it, type your toll statement. But for the Englewood telephone user, it's as easy as dialing a local call. Remember that number Mrs. Warren looked up in her personal telephone notebook? 318-Garfield 5-2368. The only difference between that and a local number is the three digits at the beginning. 318 is the code for the San Francisco area. If her daughter had lived in Chicago, Mrs. Warren would have dialed the code 312 and then the telephone number. Cleveland, 216. Boston, 617. Altogether, more than 80 numbered areas are planned for the United States and parts of Canada. For some time past, area numbers like these have been used by telephone operators in dialing long-distance calls. When the people in the Englewood area, with one- and two-party lines, were given this service, they could dial to 13 of these areas. That meant that more than 11 million telephones could be dialed from Englewood. When will the 11 million be able to dial Englewood? And what about the remaining millions of telephones in the Bell system? The answer lies in the future. But this much we do know. Over the years, we have seen the results of a successful formula. Planned research to anticipate the demands of a growing nation. Available resources, plus the continued efforts of many people. This combination has given America steady improvements in telephone service. And the story of long-distance dialing points the way to even better telephone service for you tomorrow.
And they had no idea what was coming. They had no clue. Who would have, even, I don't know, when I was growing up in the 60s, and we had the, at first, you know, we had the dial telephones, and then, I don't know, I guess it was probably mid-60s, late-60s, they came out with, the touch tones, and then they converted everything to touch tone. And, of course, there were still some dial telephones around, the older dial, you know, like the tabletop telephones. Those things were indestructible. You know, you could, they'd fall off, you know, you'd pull on the thing, and the thing would fall on the floor, and, they were really well-built, obviously, in those days. And, of course, the phone company owned all of them. You know, you leased the equipment from the phone company, and everything was manufactured by Western Electric. If you were on a, that was part of the Bell system, of course, it was a big monopoly. And then I guess it was in the 70s that they broke up the monopoly, and then and then things changed quite a bit after that. And then cell phones came along. Now, of course, I don't know that. Even back in the, probably the 70s, they had what they called mobile phones, but, they were usually installed into a vehicle, and the vehicle had this big antenna, and they would contact the mobile operator when they wanted to make a call. And then, but we had no idea back then that eventually the cell phone would come along and really revolutionize everything. Today, of course, the regular telephone business is sort of a business that's in decline, and because very few, fewer and fewer people actually maintain a landline. Why do that when you've got you know, all these nationwide calling plans, and you've already got a cell phone that you're already carrying around. What's the point of maintaining a phone line? Especially if, you know, like in my case, they still don't offer DSL to my area. So, you know, there's really no point in having a phone, you know, a landline phone at all. So, you know, the whole thing changed radically. But I don't know. It was interesting listening to that, you know, because that was made in 1951. And they were talking, oh, the 1880s, you know, people, you know, and I'll embed the videos in the show notes, but both videos. But this one's particularly, it's got some really interesting images because they've got in it, you know, they're showing the, you know, they've got actors and what have you, you know, they're showing the boy operators and then the girl operators, and they've got, I don't know, these weird... The girl operators, they show, you know, they got this weird contraption, you know, kind of strapped to their chest, you know, where, you know, with a microphone where they can just move around and talk into that thing. It's really bizarre. So, but I'll put that in the show notes in case you want to watch it. But it's worth watching, by the way. In any case, probably better be cutting this off and see if I get headed towards bed. So I'm going to have to... I'm at the place where I'm going to be delivering. It's 7 a.m. in the morning, Eastern Time. Now, I don't know what they... Somebody's got their wires crossed somewhere. They gave me an address. It was like 202 or 212 North 7th Street, Marietta, Ohio. And that's what came across my Qualcomm, and that's what is printed on my bills, the bill of lading. Well, of course, I put that into the GPS, and the place is not located there. The place, you know, I looked it up in Google, and it has a totally different address. You know, so I don't understand that. Why do they have that wrong address in there? You know, I looked the, you know, it's a food company. I looked it up in Google, and you know, they've got a bunch of different, I don't know, three or four different things, addresses in Marietta, Ohio. The main one is 17-something Green Street, but it's absolutely, you know, it's not North 7th Street. I don't know where that came from, but it's on my bill of lading as well. It doesn't make any sense at all. So, who knows? In any case, hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.